Well, good morning. This is Herb Montgomery with Renewed Heart Ministries, and you're joining me this morning in a hotel room in Los Angeles. I got delayed or stuck in LAX last night, and so we're not in my living room this morning. I'm on my way to Victoria Islands camp meeting up in British Columbia to speak up there for the weekend. And this week, I want to share with you just a few thoughts from a story that I'm going to admit from the very beginning, I don't have all the answers to. This raises some questions in the life of Jesus that I don't understand all the implications, but it does speak to my heart, and so I want to share it with you too. We're going to begin in Luke 9:51-56, and a lot of you will be familiar with this. It says, "When the days were approaching for his ascension, he was determined to go to Jerusalem, and he sent messengers ahead of him, and they went and entered a village of the Samaritans to make arrangements for him. But they did not receive him because he was traveling toward Jerusalem." There was some prejudice between the Samaritans and the Jews in that day. It says, "When his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, 'Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them?' But he turned and rebuked them and said, 'You do not know what kind of spirit you are of. The Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them.' And they went on to another village." I want to ask you to put yourself this morning in James and John's sandals for just a moment and consider with me some very important questions with this verse. The first question is, why did James and John request if they should call fire down from heaven on these Samaritans? The answer, I believe, is even stranger because it's rooted and grounded in an Old Testament way of seeing God. Here at Renewed Heart Ministries, we spend a lot of time. It's actually our focus, our mission, to help people see God correctly. And this is based on a picture of God actually found from the Old Testament. First, there are two historical events that give James and John's request some basis. These two are first the fire of God, the fire that God rained down from heaven on Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis 19. And the second is actually Elijah and his interaction with Samaritans, actually a Samaritan king in 1 Kings chapter 1. But it gets worse before it gets better when we look at these stories, because we have to add to these two bold historical events. We have to add to these the additional numerous accounts, and we're only going to list a few of them, and the prophetic statements also in the Old Testament that give basis for their question as well. Some of these are going to be hard for some of you. If you wrestle with the Old Testament God, this is going to be a little difficult, but I want to encourage you to stay with this exercise till the end. It'll be well worth it. The first one's from Leviticus 10, verse 2, and I'm not going to give much comment to these. I'm just going to read through them so that you can get this Old Testament way of looking at God, how they could easily come up with this picture of God from the Old Testament. Leviticus 10, verse 2 says, "The fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord." Numbers 11, verse 1, "Now the people came like those who complain of adversity in the hearing of the Lord. And when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp." Numbers 16, 35, "Fire also came forth from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were offering the incense." Deuteronomy 4, 24, "For the Lord your God is a consuming fire, a jealous God." Deuteronomy 9, verse 3, "Know therefore today that it is the Lord your God who is crossing over before you as a consuming fire. He will destroy them, he will subdue them before you, so that you may drive them out and destroy them quickly, just as the Lord has spoken." In Deuteronomy 32, verse 22, Moses writes, "For a fire," speaking for the Lord, "for a fire is kindled in my anger and burns to the lowest part of the grave. It consumes the earth with its yield and sets on fire the foundation of the mountains." And we skip ahead to the prophets in Isaiah chapter 5, verse 24. Isaiah writes, "Therefore, as a tongue of fire consumes stubble, and dry grass collapses into the flame. So their root will become like rot, and their blossom blow away as dust. For they have rejected the law of the Lord, and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. Isaiah 29 verse 6 says, "From the Lord of hosts you will be punished with thunder and earthquake and a loud noise, with whirlwind and tempest and the flame of a consuming fire." And Isaiah 30 verse 30, "And the Lord will cause his voice of authority to be heard, and the descending of his arm to be seen in fierce anger, and in the flame of a consuming fire and cloudburst, a downpour of hailstones." Ezekiel 20 verse 47, "And say to the forest of Negev, hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord God, behold, I'm about to kindle a fire in you, and it will consume every green tree in you, as well as every dry tree. The blazing flame will not be quenched, and the whole surface from south to north will be burned by it." Ezekiel 22:31 says, "Thus I have poured out my indignation upon them. I have consumed them with the fire of my wrath. Their way I have brought upon their heads, declares the Lord God." And the last ones are from Amos. And this is from Amos chapter 1, verses 4, 7, 10, 12, 14, and chapter 2 as well. It says, "So I will send fire upon the house of Hazael, and it will consume the citadels of Ben-Hadad. So I will send fire upon the walls of Gaza, and it will consume her citadels. I will send fire upon the walls of Tyre, and it will consume her citadels. I will send fire upon Teman, and it will consume the citadels of Bozra. So I will kindle a fire on the walls of Reba, and it will consume her citadels amid war cries of the day of battle and the storm on the day of tempest." And Amos 2 verse 2, "So I will send fire upon Moab, and it will consume the citadels of Kerioth. And Moab will die amid tumult, and the war cries and the sound of a trumpet." Amos 2 verse 5, "So I will send fire upon Judah, and it will consume the citadels of Jerusalem." Amos 5 verse 6, and that's the last one, "Seek the Lord that you may live, or he will break forth like a fire, O house of Joseph, and it will consume with none to quench it for Bethel." The point I want to make for you is that James and John, when you consider these texts, they were fully biblical in their response to the Samaritans' rejection of Jesus. And yet Jesus rebuked them. And you can't gloss over this word rebuke too quickly. It's a strong word to describe a very strong response to them by Jesus. Now, once again, they were biblical in their response, but they were unchristlike. You see, I'm becoming more and more alarmed at modern Christians in their use of the Old Testament to justify their refusal to follow the clear teachings of Jesus and the principles of his kingdom. I was recently met by this in some comments that I made on Facebook about the execution of bin Laden. I'd made some statements about Jesus and how he told us to live, and there were quite a few people who raised examples from the Old Testament to justify what they were saying. But I want you to look at what Jesus actually taught. This is in Luke 2, 27-36. He says, "Love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. Whoever hits you on the cheek, offer him the other also. Whoever takes away your coat, do not withhold your shirt from him either. Give to everyone who asks of you, and whoever takes away what is yours, do not demand it back. Treat others the same way you want them to treat you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. If you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do the same. If you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners in order to receive back the same amount. But love your enemies. Do good. Lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for he himself is kind to ungrateful and evil men. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful." It's commands like this that cause people to look at the Old Testament God and to look at what Jesus' picture of God and to honestly just scratch their heads. And I know this raises some significant questions for some of you, and I want to just tell you it's okay to have those questions. Live in those questions for a moment. Put yourself in the same head-scratching position that those who listened to Jesus in his own day found themselves. consider for a moment, and this will, I believe, help us to make sense out of some of this. Consider what the account of Jesus' transfiguration is whispering to us. The Jews based everything that they believed about God on the law and on the prophets, the Old Testament scriptures. Now, the cultural symbols for these were Moses and what they considered to be the greatest prophet, Elijah, because he himself was translated. Now, to the law, being Moses, and the testimony, the prophets represented by Elijah. Isaiah 8:20 says, if they do not speak according to this word, it is because there is no light in them. But the picture of God that the people in Jesus' day had taken from these two sources was imperfect, it was partial, it was incomplete, and it wasn't perfect. In the transfiguration, what we are witnessing is a special transfer of authority from Moses and Elijah to Jesus, being witnessed by Jesus' disciples, Peter, James, and John. They witnessed Moses and Elijah, figures in which, in their culture, stood for the source of all their beliefs about God and how they believed God called them to live. They were standing there with Jesus. And then the Father speaks with audible voice, with his grand transition of authority now, and says, then a voice came out of the cloud saying, this is my Son, my chosen one. Listen to him. What is this saying to us? This is found in Luke 9, verse 35. God is saying here, as you have based everything you believe about me on the teachings of Moses and Elijah, now base everything you believe about me on my Son. Listen to him now. You see, although what they believed about God was based on the law and the prophets, they had grossly misinterpreted God, the God they found in the law and in the prophets. They had taken from these two sources a picture of God that honestly was lacking. We are not to think that Jesus came to abolish the law and the prophets, but rather Jesus radically reinterpreted the law and the prophets in such a unique way that it gave the people of his day a completely different picture of God. It also undermined their entire religious system that had been built on this wrong picture, and that's one of the significant reasons why they crucified him. And we find that same tension among us today. Take note of Jesus' reinterpretation of the law and the prophets, what he believed the law and the prophets were actually teaching, and keep James and John's request in the beginning in mind as you read this. In Matthew 7, verse 12, Jesus said, in everything, therefore, treat people the same way you want them to treat you, for this is the law and the prophets. This is the message of the New Testament. The Old Testament, although true, had been misunderstood. Jesus had come, by contrast, as the exact, full, complete representation of the character of God. If you've ever been watching a movie and you get to the last 10 minutes of the movie and it takes a dramatic twist and it makes you go back and reassess everything you've seen for the last hour and a half, Jesus is the last 10 minutes of the movie that makes you have to shake your head and go back and reassess everything you've read in the Old Testament. In Hebrews 1:1-3, the writer of Hebrews says, God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son, and he is the radiance of his glory, the exact representation of his nature. John 1:17-18, the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth were realized through Jesus Christ. No one had seen God at any time, but the only begotten God who is in the bosom of the Father, he has explained him. Once again, I'm not saying, according to Matthew 5:17, with Jesus' counsel in mind, I'm not saying that Jesus came to abolish the law and the prophets at all. But the picture of God the people in Jesus' day had understood from these two sources was imperfect. It was partial. It wasn't complete, and it wasn't perfect. Paul understood this when he wrote to the Corinthian believers, for we know in part and we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial, and I think it's partial, picture of God in the context of 1 Corinthians 13, this chapter on love, this partial picture of God will be done away. It's this tension between the Old Testament and the teachings of Jesus that once again caused the religious leaders of Jesus' day to reject him. It is this tension that we need to live in today as followers of Jesus. It's this tension. question that should give us grave warning not to base our treatment of our enemies on the Old Testament stories, but rather on the life, teachings, death, and resurrection of God Himself in the person of Jesus Christ. When we find tension between the Old Testament and Jesus' clear commands, we must by default side with Jesus' clear commands and assume we are misinterpreting something in the Old Testament. Remember, Jesus had the same Old Testament scriptures. There was no New Testament in His day. Jesus interpreted the Old Testament in such a way that it allowed Him to still give the Old Testament authority in His life. We don't need to throw out the Old Testament. Simultaneously, the way Jesus looked at the Old Testament gave Him a radically different picture of God than what others had gotten from that same Old Testament. This should speak volumes to us. Lastly, I hope that those who need to hear this right now will understand what I am saying and what I'm not saying. When we look at the violence of Christian church history, and even today's American nationalistic violent version of Christianity, we do not find that the teachings of Jesus have been tried and found wanting. As G.K. Chesterton said, we find that the teachings of Jesus have been found difficult and left untried. Thinking of all those this week who aren't believers, but who are watching us today from the outside, my hope is that the day will soon come when the label Christian is used once again to designate those who are actually following Jesus' teachings. Gandhi himself said, "I would be a Christian if I could find one." Gandhi's genuine frustration with Christianity was that we, as Christians, who claim to follow Jesus, fail to really take seriously the kind of life Jesus taught us to live. I long for the day when, as in the first century, Christianity once again truly reflects what Jesus taught, how Jesus lived, and what Jesus' kingdom was all about. I want to be a part of that. Something worthy of wrestling of for sure this week. Once again, as we close, remember, as Ephesians 5, 1 and 2 says, imitate God, live in love, love like Christ, and go build the kingdom. I love you guys. We'll see you next week.